Hi, John Dwyer here, and welcome to my WOW Manifesto 10-point marketing system to attract more customers more often for your business. I'm going to try and keep this CD and all of the CDs in this program pretty down to earth. If you're like me, you've probably listened to a whole bunch of business coaches over the years, and some of them, when they put these CD programs together, get a little bit too technical and a little bit too academic. My style is more down to earth and hopefully a little entertaining, because I think that if you get a bit of a laugh out of things, and I guess you hear a lot of case studies, then it will be easier for you to take in the information. So let's start this particular section, which is who, why, and where. And let me just explain to you what I'm talking about when I say who, why, and where. Whatever business you're in, it doesn't matter whether you're a butcher, baker, or candlestick maker, you need to know who your target audience is, okay? And you need to know why they are your target audience, and you need to know where they are, okay? So you need to know pretty much all about them, the entire demographic profile of them. There are so many businesses these days that just forget that. It's the very basics. Before you put together any strategies or any creatives, you need to know who your target audience is. And I'm flabbergasted just by how many big companies are failing to, keep up the research in their business to determine who their target audience is. And a lot of them think they know, but over the course of many years, that audience may well have changed. With technology being what it is these days, there's every chance that your target audience of yesteryear is perhaps not the audience you should be chasing now, purely and simply because of perhaps a geodemographic change in your area, or perhaps a change in the needs and wants of consumers. So let me give you an example of how to determine your target audience. It really comes down to as simple as the 80-20 rule, and I'm sure you've heard that. 80% of most businesses, 80% of the revenue for most businesses come from around about 20% of their customers. And don't take me literally on that. It might be 70-30, it might be 90-10, depending upon what business you're in. But conventional wisdom basically sort of says that, for most businesses, 80% of their business is generally coming from about 20% of their customers. And yet a lot of those businesses continue to spend just as much time on the 80% of customers who represent only a small proportion of their business. So therefore, I guess what I'm saying is that, when you sit down and have a look at whatever your goods or services are, look for your most profitable customer at this very moment, and then look for more people who look like him or her, because that's what it's all about. If you're a hairdresser, let's say you're a lady hairdresser, and you're in one of the more upmarket suburbs, and you know that the majority of your profits come from women who are well-to-do. Women who are more likely going to be driving a BMW or Mercedes. And so therefore, if you were going to do any local marketing, let's say it was a letterbox brochure for argument's sake, then you would be looking to drop your letterbox brochures in homes or in streets where there are homes that likely would have those particular women. Okay, and let's just say that you drill down even further and your most profitable customer happens to be women over the age of 45, who come from, a well-to-do suburb. Now that means is that if you go to the letterbox brochure companies, you'll be able to use their geodemographic profiling to determine the streets that likely have a good percentage of those women, and then you'll be able to target your letterbox brochures accordingly. Or if you go through the online path of doing, Google AdWords or perhaps Facebook advertising, you can make sure that you put in the relevant data so that your ads are going to be hopefully responded to by women in that particular demographic. So it's all about determining who your most profitable customer is and then going to look for more people who look like them. I guess, too, when it's all said and done, once you determine who your target audience is, see if you can segment that audience into profit segments. Okay, so I'm just giving you an example with regards to the hairdresser, and I was making the assumption that pretty much most of the profits for that hairdresser came from women over 45 who were in what we call in the advertising game the AB demographic. And in the advertising world, let me just explain that to you. We have two terms for demographics. It's the AB demographic, as in ABCD, okay? It's the AB demographic, and they tend to be professionals. And to give you an example, they might be higher paid white collar workers, as in senior management. They might be lawyers, they might be accountants, and so on. Might be dentists and doctors, all right? And then we have the CD demographic, which tends to be working class people. And if I looked for professions that working class people more than likely were represented in, it might be truck driver, it might be plumbers, it might be hairdressers, it might be electricians and so on and so forth. So that's why I was saying with an upmarket hairdresser, the lady that owned that particular business might be looking for people, you know, women in the AB demographic, which would be the, you know, the higher income demographic. However, there are a whole host of businesses that would have a wide range of profitable customers, and it's a matter of segmenting that particular target audience, perhaps into age groups, maybe socioeconomic segments. It may be that you segment your database into average unit sale segments. There's a whole host of different segments that you can create, depending upon, you know, your business, of course, and you can then talk to those segments differently. So take, for example, a client that I had in Sydney, happens to be one of the big leagues clubs. Now, this particular leagues club, like all clubs, was interested in attracting people who enjoyed playing the poker machines. Okay, and in the leagues club instance, the reason that they like to do that is because largely the poker machines are, you know, the cash cow that helps pay for those very expensive rugby league players running around each weekend. So therefore, we would put together a campaign for this particular club that targeted people who, you know, had fallen into our segment of, gamers, okay, people that wanted to play the gaming machines. And in this particular area, it happens to be in the western part of Sydney, the Asian people and the Arab people have a tendency to enjoy gambling probably more than Australians. Now, we were able to segment that particular target audience and understand in what areas they lived, and then we were able to target our letterbox brochures accordingly. Now, there was another segment that was important to the club, and that segment were people who enjoyed coming to the club for their dining facilities. And so therefore, there were some overlaps, of course, but largely speaking, those people tended to be more Anglo-Saxon. They might have dabbled in the poker machines every now and again, but largely they came to the club for dining and for entertainment. So we would actually put together communications that were very different from the communications that we would give the gaming people. Okay, and I won't bore you with all the details of how we segmented each one, but you can imagine one was very dining orientated and spoke about the entertainment, and another, you know, in terms of the gaming people, spoke all about, you can't promote gaming externally these days if you're a club. That's not able to be done, but you can infer that, you know, if you come to the club, you're going to enjoy facilities whereby you might be able to win money. So therefore, we basically tailor-made our communications to suit each of those target audiences. And then there was another segment, and that happened to be the seniors, and they enjoyed, of course, you know, various pastimes like bingo and various other outings, indoor lawn bowls and things like that. So, of course, you spoke to them differently. So think about your own business and think about how you can, A, determine who your most profitable customer is, and then go about looking for more people like him. And I'll go through that in just a moment, how you can do that very cost effectively. And then if you do have a large or wide target audience of various groups of people, see if you can segment those into two or three or five, whatever it might be, areas, and determine if you need to speak to them separately, very differently. Let me tell you about this one. My 22-year-old daughter, Nicole, is planning to be a naturopath, and she's doing university at the moment for the purpose of getting her qualifications. And look, it's pretty clear to me that the majority of her target audience, when she becomes a naturopath, are more than likely going to be probably Gen Y, Gen X. Okay, so somewhere between 18 and maybe, you know, late 30s. And the reason I say that is because Nicole, who doesn't live at home anymore, she lives with her boyfriend, but she lives, you know, probably 20 minutes away from where my wife and myself live. We have breakfast with her once every week, normally on a weekend, a Saturday or Sunday, and she's decided that she's taking us to organic cafes now because of the health kick that she's on. You know, if she's soon to be a naturopath, I can understand that. So my wife and myself are now eating lots of food that has still got the roots on the end of them. So, but when we go to this cafe, it's pretty clear that the Gen Y and Gen X age groups are most likely the majority of the target audience for a naturopath. It just, don't get me wrong, there's a few people our age that are in their 50s, and there's probably a few people that are older than that. But the vast majority of people, whenever we go to any of these organic cafes, and she has taken us to quite a few, are Gen X and Gen Y. And so therefore, if she's going to be offering advice in the natural health area when she comes out of uni, if she starts her own business, which I'm encouraging her to do, both online and offline, then, of course, she would be smart, firstly, to do her homework and make sure that that's still the case when she comes out of uni. But she would be very wise to then target that audience and use communication tactics, both online and offline, and use language that suits that audience. And speaking of language, let me tell you, when I got involved with the Greater Building Society many years ago now, more than a dozen or so years ago, they were using an advertising agency at the time that was putting together all of their communications, television, radio, newspaper, direct mail, letterbox brochures, the whole thing, radio. And it so happened that the same copywriters that were looking after the home loan collateral and advertisements were pretty much the same copywriters that were looking after other products. For example, the pensioner, seniors accounts, savings accounts, and it may well be personal loans. And when I looked at the copy on all of their brochures, keeping in mind that a pensioner account, a savings account for a pensioner, targets a very different audience to a personal loan, because most personal loans, something like 70-odd% of personal loans, are taken out by people under 25, and the majority of those people are taking out a $10,000 or $15,000 loan for their first car, their first vehicle. And so therefore, if you were to use the word wicked in the personal loan brochure that might be delivered around the university campuses to try and attract, you know, young Gen Ys to get interested in a $10,000 or $15,000 loan, if you were to use the word wicked in that brochure, they'd get what you mean, or should I say wicked sick, okay? I'm probably showing my age because I think that was probably a couple of years ago now anyway, but if you were to use that sort of language, then at least, even if it was 2 or 3 years old, they would know what wicked sick means, and of course it means good and cool. If you were to use that same language in the pensioner brochure, it means something entirely different. And the point I'm getting at is that it, when I looked at the copy in the brochure that was being produced for the pensioners, and the copy that was being produced for the personal loan brochure, which would be for the Gen Ys, the copy was written in the same tonality. It was written in the same genre, okay? Now, it, don't think for a moment that the term wicked sick or any of that stuff was used. Of course it wasn't. I was only saying that a moment ago to sort of express my point. But the thing was that I could see that the copy was written by the same copywriter, and it was written moreover for the pensioners than it was for the young people. And so, look, I just got involved pretty quickly and advised the Building Society that they should look at having different copywriters for the different segments that they were chasing, okay? And I guess that's what I'm saying for you, is that if you do have a number of segments in terms of your customers that are delivering profits to your business, then be aware that you may very well need to talk to them differently. For example, real estate. I do quite a few real estate seminars, and I say to the people in the audience, I cannot understand why they send out the literature, their collateral, to what they call their farm area, which is the homes in their area. And basically, it's a one brochure fits all. I mean, most of it's pretty ordinary anyway. I'm sure you would agree, whether you're in the real estate industry or not, that it really is... The collateral that real estate agents send out is quite bland. It's normally, saying something like, we have buyers in your area and we're looking for homes. We don't have enough stock at the moment. So if you're thinking of possibly listing your home, give us a call. It's about as exciting as that, as we all know, okay? My point is that if the real estate agent did their homework and used the facilities that are available to them to determine who is in their farm area, and that is how many families are there, how many couples, how many seniors, or what they call empty nesters, where the children have moved on, and all that information is available to them via the census data that we fill in every, the form that we fill in every 4 or 5 years, then that means is that if they know where those pockets are, then they can produce not one, but rather 2 or 3 or 4 different brochures. So if they were going into an area which was largely populated by empty nesters, that is seniors whose children have left, then that brochure would be entirely different from the one that they would send out to the streets where there were family homes. Because the one with empty nesters, the brochure would more than likely say, you know what, are you over 55 and, the kids have moved on now and so you're in a big house all by yourself, why don't you think about downsizing and putting some money in the bank? And guess what? We have a bunch of people at the moment on our database and knocking on our real estate door who are looking for your sort of home, because they're looking for X number of bedrooms and they're looking for the backyard and so forth. And of course, the communications from the real estate agent to a family with 3 little children would be entirely different. So that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that, you've got to determine your target audience. Foster's, for example, they would argue, this is Foster's beer, they would argue, I'm sure, that their target audience is predominantly working class men. Whereas Crown Lager would probably say, no, look, ours are, senior white collar management, okay, or professionals. And the way that you see Foster's being advertised, or 4X being advertised, is very, very different, isn't it, from Crown Lager. One is very upmarket, Rolls-Royce, Mercedes-Benz level, and of course the Foster's and the 4X's beer, you'll see guys in their board shorts and T-shirts on the beach with an Esky, very, very different. Okay, so you've got to determine who your target audience is. Now, let me move on to why, and although I've said up until this point, the reason why is so that you can cost effectively target them. I mean, that's very clear. Of course, the reason you want to find out who your target audience is in terms of who your most profitable customer is because you want to be able to target that customer cost effectively. Okay. The idea is to ensure that, I guess, you get maximum return for every marketing dollar that you spend. Okay. So, I mean, that's just why this sort of analysis and research should really be high priority for you. You not only need to understand the target audience for your own business and the reasons why they actually I guess, frequent your business, but you also need to make sure that you research your competitors. Okay, now, I guess, call it a SWOT analysis, if you like. And if you're not familiar with that, the SWOT is not spelt like it normally would be with a SWOT team. It's SWOT, which stands for strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. It's an oldie but a goldie. And if you've heard it before, then I apologize because you're probably rolling your eyes going, oh, JD, of course we know what a SWOT is. But if you have heard it before, or if you haven't heard it before, do yourself a favor and do a SWOT analysis of your business. Okay, strengths, what are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? What are the opportunities for your business? And what are the threats? And that's another thing that you should do from tomorrow. Get underway with doing a SWOT analysis. But you also should research your competitors, okay? Which I guess the T in the SWOT stands for, and that is threats, okay? Research your competitors, find out what they're doing, okay? You need to research your prospective clients, and that is people who are not currently your clients, but you think that they might be, and I'll tell you how to go about doing that in a moment. If your target audience is of an age group that you feel would be responsible to letterbox brochures, then that's fine, and that's where geodemographic targeting would come into play, and I'll go through that in just a moment. And if your target audience tends to be more online, for whatever reason, yeah, your goods or services are predominantly sold online, then of course you know how to go about chasing down that audience. It's all about making sure that your website is search engine optimized so that those people who are looking for those key phrases are going to find you on the front page of Google, hopefully in number one spot. And of course, on top of that, you've got the facility of social media advertising, Facebook and perhaps LinkedIn if you're in business and you're tracing business people, Twitter, of course, and not to forget, of course, Google AdWords. So if you have determined who your target audience is, and you understand the reason why you need to do that is to make your advertising cost effective, then where are they? Okay. I've, you know, sort of often preached from stage in my seminars, a facility that's available to everyone, to every business owner, and that's called geodemographic profiling. Okay, and courtesy of the census that we fill in every 4 or 5 years, the government knows, you know, who we are, what our habits are, and where we live, but they're not the only ones. Some software specialists out there have grabbed hold of that information and then they resell it. Now, in Australia, a company called Pacific Micro Marketing has a software package called Mosaic. Okay, so it's Pacific Micro Marketing. And they have this software package called Mosaic, which provides you with information about the demographic and geographic profile of Australian households. And so what it does, it tells you the nationalities, it tells you all about the ages, jobs, the likes and the dislikes of householders right around Australia. Okay. Now, this can be unbelievably valuable for your business, for any business. Okay. Now, these details, where did they come from? Well, they came from the last census survey. And they're available to you right now, okay? So it'll, you know, basically be worth gold to you, I can assure you, okay? Just imagine the benefits that this type of information can provide if you're planning to letterbox deliver brochures to householders, okay? And even if you're not doing letterbox brochures, although I do admit that it certainly, I guess, is of particular value to people who are doing, or to businesses that are doing that. But even if you're not doing that, it still is very important to know geographically, you know, where your target audience lives, okay? Now, there's some good news. If you were to go to Pacific Micro Marketing, you could get access to this information, but you'd probably have to hand over a check of $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000, depending upon what package you buy, because obviously, you know, they have different size packages for different businesses, okay? But you can actually get your hands on this virtually for free, okay, through the letterbox distribution companies. And there are two letterbox distribution companies in Australia, and one of them is called Salmat, S-A-L-M-A-T, and their their web address is just salmat.com.au, and the other large letterbox distribution company is PMP Distribution. That's P for Peter, M for Mary, P for Peter. So that's PMP Distribution, and their web address is PMP Limited, and that's the full word limited, okay? PMPLimited.com.au. Okay, so if you go to both of those companies' websites, you'll see that they do provide this information. Salmat call theirs not Mosaic. I think they call theirs Market Find or something like that, but it's the same sort of thing. So therefore, what's geodemographic profiling? Okay, basically, consumers all around Australia have been categorised on the basis of their personal demographics, as I said before, on age and income. Okay, they have also been categorised according to their values and attitudes, and on the basis of their behaviour. Okay, so therefore, I guess you could say geodemographic classification is simply a method which categorises people into groups based on the types of neighbourhoods in which they live. And if neighbourhoods are similar across a wide range of demographic measures, then it's probable that they will offer similar potential across most products, brands, services and media. So for argument's sake, they've broken up Australia into 11 major categories. And I'll give you the names of those in just a minute, but they basically, it's the census data. When I say they, I mean the Australian government has broken up Australians into 11 geodemographic profiles. I'll give them to you now. Let me just read them out to you, okay? Privileged prosperity, and obviously that means they're, you know, upmarket people, they've got a few dollars. Academic achievers. Next one, young ambition. Next one, pushing the boundaries. Next one, family challenge. Metro multiculture, as in, you know, obviously there are a lot of multicultural people in the metropolitan area. Learners and earners, that's going to be young but upwardly mobile, you know, people. Provincial optimism, farming stock, suburban subsistence, which means basically, you know, general working class people in the suburbs, and community disconnect. Now, those 11 groups basically allow you, you can get a description of each one of those groups from the letterbox brochure companies, and you can have a look at the description of these particular people that are in those 11 groups and determine what percentage within the 11 groups really, you know, are relevant to your business. How many of those 11 groups do you see as being a member of your target audience? So, for example, if you're in the business of providing, day spa facilities, and your likely audience consists of upmarket women, then you're able to pinpoint the general areas within postcodes where those particular women live. So, for example, when I went through the 11 sections there before, geodemographic sections, and I'm talking about, you know, academic achievers and young ambitions and learners and earners and so on and so forth, you probably find that, for day spa facilities, your target audience, or a lot of your target audience, might fall into the category which, are deemed as being privileged prosperity, okay, because they can afford to go and have a day spa. Now, I'm not saying that literally, obviously. I mean, I don't own a day spa, so I can't tell you precisely who uses that, but I'm just taking a best guess. And, if you are a kitchen renovation company, or for that matter, a carpet cleaning company, you're probably going to want to stay away from areas that have a high rental population. Because at the end of the day, of course, it's the owners of the home that would want the carpet cleaned or want their kitchen renovated. And the beaut thing about getting access to this geodemographic data is that if you are going to do a letterbox brochure, then you can stay clear of those suburbs that have a high percentage of rental properties, because there's no you know, there's no tenant who is going to ask you to come in and refurbish the kitchen. Maybe there is, but they shouldn't. Okay. So you can see just how valuable grabbing this stuff is, okay? And of course, you know, from an online perspective, then, you know, geodemographic profiling doesn't come into play as it would in terms of letterbox brochures, but by the same token, it's somewhat reverse engineered in the sense that you just make sure that your website has been search engine optimized sufficiently enough, or well enough, to get you on the front page of Google searches for a whole host of key phrases that you would expect your target audience would be pumping into Google. By the way, with regards to the geodemographic profiling facilities that the letterbox brochure companies can give you, they're almost free. They're not exactly free, but they're near enough to it. In my experience, to do letterbox brochures in Australia, normally either of those two companies, and again, don't quote me, but normally they would charge around $40 per thousand to letterbox distribute your flyer, okay? And if you want to access their geodemographic profiling facility, which I would very much recommend that you do so that you're not just spraying bullets, I think they normally charge about an extra $5 per thousand. So, wowee. I mean, you know, if it's 4 cents to drop your brochure, but if you can get the geodemographic segmentation, which will be highly valuable to you, and it takes it from 4 cents to 4.5 cents, I think it would be a very worthwhile exercise. Okay, now, some other interesting stuff. Okay, now, in terms of research, and to a degree, that's what this particular CD is all about. It's all about knowing who, it's all about knowing why, and it's all about knowing where. And I guess if I was to put a tagline underneath that, it means that you need to do research, you need to do analysis, you need to do your homework before you sit down to prepare your marketing strategies with or without wow factors, hopefully with wow factors, okay? And it really is a shame, but many businesses, even the big guys, are running so fast, particularly in this particular, could I use particular anymore? Probably not. Particularly in this climate, just running so fast that they forget to do research. And for goodness sake, just pull up stumps and get some research done. And it's nowhere near as expensive as you might think it is, okay? Too many companies think, oh, we'll put it off because we just can't afford it. Well, it's not as expensive as you think it is. And why is research important? Let me give you a couple of examples, okay, of things that have gone wrong and these companies would wish, if they had their time over again, that they could have done research. 7-Up. If you've been to the United States, you'll probably know that their lemonade in the United States, that, or at least the what they call lemon lime, but it's lemonade to us, is really, 7-Up have a stranglehold on it. So almost to the stage where, just as if when you're doing a photocopy in America, you ask for a Xerox, you use the brand name, whereas here, more than likely in Australia, we would say, look, can we get a photocopy? Well, in America, if you're after a lemonade, basically you just ask for a 7-Up. That's how big a share of the market that 7-Up has. Now, they decided many, many, many years ago, 25 or 30 years ago, that they would take the Australian marketplace by storm. This is 7-Up, okay? And they launched in Australia and used exactly the same campaign that they had used in the United States, which had been unbelievably successful. And because the United States has a lot of cola drinks, in fact, I think the largest number of colas of any country in the world, even though Coca-Cola and Pepsi really own the market, there's a whole lot of no-name style colas there as well, then 7-Up marketed themselves as the unusual because it was really the only lemonade on the market for a long while. So it marketed itself as the unusual. And its ads in America had this dungeon, almost like a basement nightclub-y sort of thing, with lots of vampire-y sort of people dressed up drinking this unusual drink. And they were unusual, okay? They weren't vampires, but they were, you know, they were dressed up in pretty weird sort of horror clothing, okay? And worked like a treat in America because when, you know, in a country where they were predominantly drinking cola, this lemon lime, they call it over there, lemonade, called 7-Up was unusual. Well, of course, they brought the campaign to Australia and just basically ran it. And guess what? Nothing. Nothing happened. They hardly sold a bottle. And the reason was is that those that did try the lemonade of 7-Up found that it was just the same as pretty much Schweppes lemonade here, or I think we had Lead lemonade, or we had a whole bunch of lemonades anyway. Shelley's, I think, had a brand. And so therefore, it was not unusual. Now, they didn't do their homework. They didn't check what the Australian marketplace was like at the time in terms of lemonades. And they packed up and went back to America. They went home. And 7-Up, I think, may have only just come back in recent times. I'm not sure whether it's back in Australia for with a high distribution. I think I may have seen it in a few places, but it certainly isn't back to the level that they would have wanted 25 or so years ago when they came in. Now, another classic example of not doing research was the Woolworths attempt to get us to pay $1 for our trolleys. And I don't know whether it rolled out in your area, but certainly a lot of supermarkets on the Gold Coast where I live decided, Woolworths decided that they would charge you $1 to get one of their trolleys out of the trolley bay, take it through and get your groceries, and then when you took it up to your car and unloaded all your groceries in the back of your car, if you wanted your dollar back, you had to take the trolley along to one of the bays where they were, and then push it in, and then, you know, the whatever it was, the little dispenser would, you know, kick out your $1 coin. And I thought, oh, gosh, you know, this is all to save the young kids running around the car park picking up the trolleys and therefore save wages and probably make a few dollars on those people that couldn't be bothered taking their trolley back to get the dollar. It lasted around about 3 or 4 months, okay? I'm sure they didn't do any research to find out what the annoyance factor would be with consumers, and they pretty quick smart just brought back the free trolleys. That's why you need to do market research, okay? At the Greater Building Society, which I had looked after their marketing for a dozen or so years, what we would do is that we would use an online research company to determine the potential success of our television commercials. And this particular research company that we used online was called Research Now. And you can have a look at their website if you like. Just go to Research Now and have a look at it. And basically what we would do is that we'd send out 2 or 3 ads, and even the Jerry Seinfeld ones of recent years, we would send out 2 or 3 ads, and they would have 1,000-odd people that they have on their database look at these TV ads, courtesy of, you know, a YouTube-y sort of video, and they would tell us pretty much which ones they would more than likely react to, okay? And so therefore, it wasn't a surprise that most of our television campaigns worked like a dream, because we had already run them past 1,000 people, and we got the response back within 48 hours, and that's the great part about doing online research. It just happened so quickly. So look them up, Research Now. When we were doing this, I think it was around about $3,000 or $4,000, maybe $5,000. To get 1,000 people to look at the ad and or the ads, 3 ads, and answer a series of questions. But you can also use SurveyMonkey. And if you're not familiar with that, go and have a look at SurveyMonkey online. And you'll see that they provide you with survey templates, okay, which provide you with question types, and they give you the ability to customize your survey. And you've got the ability to choose lots of different question types, okay? So whether it be multiple text boxes, or they'll give you rating scales, they'll give you commentary boxes for people to fill in, and they'll give you facilities for people to fill in their demographic information. They have templates for multiple choice questionnaires. Pretty much you can save lots and lots of time by using their pre-made survey templates, okay? And the great thing is that they collect and manage your responses, okay, and they provide segmentation and analysis of the answers for you, okay, if you want. It's up to you, of course. But it's a one-stop shop, which I highly recommend that you should have a look at. Another online resource for helping you create and, I guess, analyze your own surveys is SurveyShare.com, SurveyShare.com. Where, again, there's a whole bunch of survey templates that you can choose from, okay? And the great thing about, you know, having a template like this is that you just don't have to do hardly any work. It's just all sitting there for you. So think about, yeah, SurveyMonkey and also the other one that I've just given you, which is SurveyShare.com. www.thebusinessmanlife.com. Both of those would be very handy for you to, you know, do some online research if you want to find out what people think of your products and what they think of your services. And by the way, to when you are doing online surveys like that, it's pretty much built for quantitative research, not so much qualitative. And if you're wanting to know, well, okay, what's the difference between quantitative and qualitative? Quantitative is research that I guess aims to provide you with statistical numbers, okay? Whereas quantitative, that's quantitative, okay? So it's research that aims to provide you with statistical numbers, whereas qualitative research is designed to find out what people think about your products or services. I guess it's more touchy-feely. You know, what do they think about your brand? What do they think about your packaging? What do they think about the general taste? What do they think about the look? What do they think about the benefits? So it's more, yeah, it's more about the quality of what you do. But quantitative research is, look, we've asked 1,000 people and 68% of them think blah, 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 blah. So let's just give you an example of a quantitative research, okay? Let's just you were, you know, manufacturing a breakfast cereal, and you wanted to, you know, find out a number of things about the breakfast cereal. So therefore, you went out and asked 1,000 people, and the results might have come in something like 62% of respondents indicated that they thought that the breakfast cereal wasn't healthy enough. It didn't have enough organic ingredients, okay? And the same statistical analysis might show that 24% of males thought that the design of the box was really cool, 51% thought it was okay, and the other whatever it is percent thought it was ugly. Whereas 68% of females thought the box was pretty, okay, and so on and so forth. It might have been a pink box. So it's all about statistical data. Normally, you know, it comes with asking a sample size of at least 500. And if you're going to do quantitative research, I believe that you should do at least 400 or 500. Now, qualitative research is when you might get, you might get a group of, say, 8 or 10 people in a room. A facilitator would probe and explore their responses to various questions. Okay, so therefore, I would suspect that most businesses would do, 4, maybe 5, maybe 6 groups of 8 to 10 people. And, you know, if you go down that track, then just make sure that you've got some sort of comfortable venue, whether you hire out a boardroom in an office building, or whether you hire out a room at a local club that can be relatively quiet. The whole idea is that you should definitely choose the right facilitator, because he will stop motor mouths from taking over the whole evening. But a good facilitator will also, you know, just be able to minimize any distractions, for that matter, okay? Because you don't want, you know, just one or two attention seekers in the group prejudicing the opinions of everyone else. So if he holds up the box and says, look, what do you think about the design of this box? And one or two people jump in and steal everyone's thunder all the time, then of course your qualitative research results are going to be skewed, and you don't want that, okay? But of course, when you do these qualitative, research studies, research groups of 8 or 10 people, just make sure that you do have representation across different age groups, if your product appeals to different age groups, so that you can get some sort of segmentation. I must say that if you ask me what particular research I would favour, I tend to always favour the one that's got more statistical integrity to it. And I believe the one that has more statistical integrity to it, obviously, is the one that asks more people the question. And so, therefore, I tend to favour quantitative research myself. If you've got a limited budget, I would head towards that path. But nonetheless, if your budget can suffice, then do both, because it's lovely to get the touchy-feely sort of comments too when you do qualitative research. It's just that I'm always worried that if budget is tight and you only get three groups of 8 to 10 people, and for whatever reason, those groups are influenced by one or two people in the group, then you might go changing your product or your service because of what 25 or 30 people are saying in terms of their responses to your products or services or packaging or whatever it might be. And I just don't think that's enough to make a value judgment and to make a, you know, a big decision. That's why I do favour research that has 400 or 500 people in it myself. But as I said, if the budget's there, then certainly do both, because qualitative research can dig out some things that you just wouldn't find in terms of customer opinions if you were, you know, only doing quantitative. And last but not least is the fact that if you are collecting a database, and please tell me that you are, then of course you can fortuitously use that database as a means to doing a lot of research without having to spend a lot of money. And I'm not suggesting that you annoy that database very often, but I am suggesting that maybe once every 6 months, maybe once every 12 months, you could send them out a questionnaire and give them an incentive. You know, it might be a prize. They can win a prize of, you know, a trip to the Gold Coast theme parks or whatever it may be, if they were to just answer some questions for you. And the good thing about having a database is that you can do that at the press of a button these days. And if you're not collecting a database, please start collecting a database. If you've been part of my environment, you will know that I'm an unbelievable fan of collecting a database. Okay, you just cannot believe the value there is in having your own tribe and knowing who they are and knowing how to contact them. But if you are a person, a business owner that has collected a database, then, you know, your questions could be related to both your online presence and offline presence. It could be, look, you know, you could win a trip to the Gold Coast, staying at the Versace. We're giving away a wonderful prize, but you need to fill in this very simple survey for us and, you know, email it back to us by Friday. And that survey might be asking them what they think of your website, what they think of your products or services, what they think of your pricing. If you're a bricks and mortar business, what do they think about the layout of your business or your shop? What do they think of your on-time delivery, the promptness of your responses to their queries, the proximity of their business? Is it handy for you? Is our online ordering system easy to navigate? All that sort of stuff. So you can just ask them a whole bunch of questions about your services or your products. And because you've given them an incentive to get back to you by Friday or whatever, whenever it might be, then bingo, you know, you're going to have a survey done and dusted probably within, 2, 3, or 4 days. How good would that be? Not even having to put your hand in your pocket, okay? So look, that's about it. I'll wrap it up for who, why, and where. Hopefully this has been of a lot of value for you. Before you put your strategy or your creative together for your marketing plan, this is the stuff you have to start with. And that's why CD number one in this program is all about who, why, and where. Look forward to talking to you on the next CD.